This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Watchdog's chief rejects allegation that Russia manipulated inspectors' visit to Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Grossi says, quote, "We've seen all I requested." The United States announces a new arms deal with Taiwan worth more than $1 billion. That's amid soaring tensions with China. Also ahead, unsealed U.S. court records show the FBI found over 11,000 government documents at Trump's Florida home. They include dozens of empty folders labeled classified. Hello and welcome. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour. The UN Nuclear Agency has expressed concern about the physical condition of the facilities at Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant due to ongoing fighting and shelling in the area.
First is the physical integrity of the facilities. We have been seeing military activity around the plant, and I was able to see myself and my team impact holes, markings on buildings of shelling. So it means that the physical integrity of the facility has been violated not once, but several times. And this is something irrespective of the kinetic power of whatever you are throwing at the plant is unacceptable in any way, under any safety and security criteria.
Grossi was speaking to reporters in Vienna following a visit to the Russian-controlled plant. The mission sought to survey operations and assess potential damage at the atomic plant. Grossi also dismissed allegations that his visit was restricted or manipulated, saying he saw everything he asked to see. The Kremlin says it views the inspector's visit to Zaporizhzhia as very positive. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for the repeated shelling of the plant.
Inflicting strikes on the facilities of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, Kiev creates a real threat of a nuclear catastrophe in Europe. According to international law, this is nothing but nuclear terrorism.
The Russian defense minister also accused the U.S. and the European Union of encouraging reckless actions around the nuclear plant by providing Ukraine with weapons. Kiev has admitted bombing what it called a Russian base in a district where the Zaporizhzhia power plant is located. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president has welcomed the arrival of the IAEA delegation in Zaporizhzhia. Volodymyr Zelensky, however, criticized Russia for barring international journalists from entering the facility. He also complained about Grossi failing to call for the demilitarization of the area. The G7 group of countries has agreed to impose a price cap on Russian oil imports despite warnings from the Kremlin. Here's the German finance minister with the stated purposes of the move.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
Importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries now need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap has not been decided yet. The G7 says the maximum price will be set by a, quote, broad coalition of countries. It's expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. The move is part of a range of measures taken by the West and its allies targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets. As Italy is crippled with soaring energy costs, its government is discussing the adoption of energy-saving measures for the winter. Some members of the EU have already introduced similar measures in an attempt to reduce gas usage. Max Schiavelli reports from Rome.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian recently visited Moscow. He discussed several issues there, including the JCPOA revival talks. But significantly, the top Iranian diplomat also delivered a message from an anonymous European leader for a peace initiative with Ukraine. This shows how Iran can play the role of a mediator in world conflicts, unlike the U.S., which has been fueling the flames of war in Ukraine.
The crisis in Ukraine, which began in February 2022, is arguably the most important event since the fall of the Soviet Union, which has had global ramifications. The crisis has given rise to new alliances and enmities. There have been various attempts and roadmaps to resolve the conflict. Messages have also been exchanged between the involved parties through various means to put an end to the crisis. In the latest such example, it has emerged that Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who visited Russia's capital Moscow earlier this week, was carrying a message from a European leader to Russia over Ukraine. Although the name of the European leader is unknown, some reports say the Western leader in question is the French President Emmanuel Macron.
Indeed, this is the fact that Iran is emerging now as a very important, not just regional player, but global player. And the fact that Iran is getting involved not just in resolving its own problems with the United States and Israel, but in resolving global issues such as the NATO push to the east is an important new step for Iran on the world stage. Indeed, this is a historic moment for Iran.
The details of the peace initiative have also not been revealed, but Amir Abdollahian said he discussed humanitarian issues, the prisoners, and the issue of the Zaporizhia nuclear plant. Since the conflict began in February, Iran has conveyed messages between Moscow and Kiev several times, but this is the first publicized instance of Tehran delivering a message from Europe. Iran has often expressed its readiness to act as an honest broker in any talks aimed at bringing an end to the conflict. and now the mediation role of Tehran between Moscow, Kiev and the West testifies to the growing importance of Iran at the international stage.
The word on the street, as they say, is that the party trying to help bring peace in this conflict is France. And the reason why France is doing this is an attempt on the local part of France to become a more important power within Europe. It has been more than 20 years since France has done anything independently in Europe without the go-ahead from Germany. And what this signifies is that France is attempting, at least the current administration in the French government, is attempting to separate itself somewhat from Germany, which has been the leader of the EU.
Ever since Russia launched what it calls a special military operation in Ukraine, the U.S. and its European allies haven't made the type of effort needed to resolve the conflict diplomatically. One report revealed how Ukraine and Russia in April were ready for a possible peace deal, but UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that from happening. Quite a remarkable contrast to how Iran has approached the conflict.
The conflict between Russia and Ukraine has exposed deep problems within the EU. It has further highlighted the United States' influence over the bloc and the military alliance NATO. It's been reported that Russia and Ukraine were close to reaching a deal to end the war, which would have made Ukraine vow that it would never seek NATO membership. But the efforts were scuttled due to the Western pressure, most notably from the UK and the US. UK's outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson is said to have dictated to Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Kiev was ready to sign a deal with Russia, Ukraine's Western benefactors were not. Now, nearly 7 months into the war, European countries are beginning to feel the economic costs of their ambitions for the eastward expansion of NATO. The UK is now experiencing its worst inflation in years and is on the brink of a recession. Economists predict that inflation is likely to top 20% next year. EU countries are not doing better either, with annual inflation of 9.1% for August. Experts have warned of a winter of discontent and a catastrophic economic fallout if the crisis lingers on. It now appears that some NATO members led by the United States are ready to keep the war going on in Ukraine at Ukraine's cost for their own benefits.
Moving on, the U.S. State Department approves potential sales of $1.1 billion worth of arms to Taiwan amid simmering tensions with China over the island. The package includes advanced anti-ship and air-to-air missiles, as well as support for Taiwan's surveillance radar systems. The deal is announced in the wake of China's military drills near Taiwan following a controversial visit to the island by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. China, that considers Taiwan part of its territory, has blasted the visit. Beijing says all U.S. exchanges with Taipei are acts of meddling and provocation. It says Washington is steering separatist sentiments in Taiwan. America's ousted president has returned home weeks after fleeing abroad amid anti-government protests. Gotabaya Rajapaksa was welcomed by a group of ministers at the capital Colombo after 2 months of exile in Singapore and Thailand. Rajapaksa was forced to leave his country after protesters stormed his official residence and office in mid-July. They blamed his government for the country's worst ever economic crisis. The protests began in April following a sharp rise in food and fuel costs. Sri Lanka is still reeling from shortage of essentials. A U.S. district judge has released a detailed inventory of the documents seized from the residence of former U.S. President Donald Trump last month. The cache seized by the FBI contains more than 11,000 government records and photos. These include 99 documents marked secret, top secret, or confidential. There are also dozens of empty folders labeled classified. The investigators are yet to clarify what happened to their contents. The FBI stormed Trump's Mar-a-Lago home on August 8th. The former president and his Republican allies have called the agency corrupt and the search a political retribution. Nearly 4 in 5 people in Afghanistan believe the U.S. war against their country didn't achieve its goal and was a, quote, complete failure. That was the outcome of a recent poll, which also found over 2/3 of people around the world shared the same opinion. Rahmatullah Bokhwan reports from Kabul.
Polled CGTN think tank showed that
the China Global Television Network and Chinese Public Opinion Institute have conducted a survey in Afghanistan and 24 global countries to assess the 20-year American war on Afghanistan.
Now, the Taliban will pay a price.
At the beginning of its presence in Afghanistan, the U.S. made a commitment to build a stable, strong, and prosperous Afghanistan, claiming it would establish democracy, fight against terrorism, and rebuild the nation. Nearly 79% of the Afghan respondents polled said the U.S. did not keep its promise, while 80% termed the U.S. war in their country a complete failure.
The U.S. never abided by its promises. Current disasters in Afghanistan have all resulted from the U.S. failures. We would witness better days today if the U.S. hadn't occupied our country. 20 years ago, the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and today they have control again. So what did the years of U.S. war and huge expenses change in our country? The U.S. claimed to bring prosperity in Afghanistan. Instead, it destroyed everything.
During the war, Afghanistan faced severe challenges with regards to security, economy, and people's livelihoods. Some 56.6% of Afghan respondents said the U.S. left the Afghan economy worse than it was in 2001. Yet 80% of global respondents believe that the causes of local terrorism still exist in the war-ravaged country.
I'd been in Afghanistan through the U.S. invasion. I agree with the results of the poll. The U.S. came to our country claiming to counter terrorism and help the Afghan economy grow, but practically none of them materialized. The U.S. institutionalized fraud and abuse. As a result, today Afghans don't have food to eat and terrorism threats are rising.
Meanwhile, 68% of the respondents said the U.S. war in Afghanistan has caused the U.S. to continue to lose its credibility with the international community. Some 65% of those surveyed in Afghanistan said they believe neighboring countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and China, play a key role in the rebuilding of the war-battered nation. 70% of global respondents described Washington seizing Afghanistan's assets as pure looting. They called on the U.S. to return Afghans' money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The death toll from an explosion in Afghanistan's western city of Herat rises to 18. Police say a high-profile pro-Taliban cleric was among those killed. Over 20 others were wounded. The blast rocked a mosque during Friday prayers. Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for Herat bomb attack. The ruling Taliban have vowed to bring to justice those behind the attack. Iran has condemned the deadly bombing.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Analysis of 126,000 cases over a decade shows black and Asian people in England wait longer for cancer diagnosis than white people. Diagnosis delays may mean fewer treatment options, while starting treatment later may also mean it is less effective, reducing the odds of survival. Here we present you an article written by Andrew Gregory under the heading, Revealed: Disturbing Race Divide on Cancer Patients' Wait Times in England. A According to a disturbing analysis of the National Health Service's waiting times, black and Asian people in England have to wait longer for a cancer diagnosis than white people, with some forced to wait an extra 6 weeks. A damning review of the world's largest primary care database by the University of Exeter and The Guardian discovered minority ethnic patients wait longer than white patients in 6 of the 7 cancers studied. Race and health leaders have called the results deeply concerning and absolutely unacceptable. The analysis of 126,000 cancer cases over a decade found the median time between a white person first presenting symptoms to a general practitioner and getting diagnosed is 55 days. For Asian people, it is 60 days, or 9% longer. For black people, it is 61 days, or 11% longer. Diagnosis delays may mean fewer treatment options, while starting treatment later may also mean it is less effective, effectively reducing the odds of survival. Previous research had already shown that ethnic minority patients have worse outcomes when it comes to some cancers in England and are less likely to report positive healthcare experiences. Some of the differences in wait times for specific cancers are incredibly stark. The median time for white people to get a diagnosis for esophagogastric cancer of the stomach or esophagus is 53 days. For Asian people, it is 100 days, more than 6 weeks longer than the median 7 weeks wait for white people. In myeloma, the third most common type of blood cancer, the median diagnosis wait time for white people is 93 days. For black people, it is 127 days, more than a month longer. The British government and the National Health Service have repeatedly promised to purportedly tackle ethnic inequalities in healthcare. Experts say the findings show serious action is needed to understand how and why black and Asian people wait longer and to prevent it from happening again. Jabir Butt, the chief executive of the Race Equality Foundation, said, "These findings are deeply worrying, with potential life-altering consequences for the health of black and Asian people." He added, "The differences are disturbing but sadly not surprising," adding, "We urgently need to address these underlying factors holding black and Asian patients back from getting a fair chance when it comes to fighting cancer." The University of Exeter looked at 126,000 cancer cases in England between 2006 and 2016. The data covered the four most common cancers: lung cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and colorectal cancer, and three commonly diagnosed in ethnic minorities: esophagogastric cancer, myeloma, and ovarian cancer. The University of Exeter researcher Tanimola Martins said the findings help explain why ethnic minorities have poorer outcomes for some cancers and report worse experiences of healthcare, adding, "We urgently need to understand why this is the case for black and Asian groups." Michelle Mitchell, the chief executive of Cancer Research UK, which funded the research, said that while the differences are unlikely to be sole explanation for the inequalities in cancer survival, at the very least, extended wait times may cause additional stress and additional anxiety for ethnic minority patients. A review of the data by The Guardian found that in 6 of the 7 cancers analysed, black or Asian patients waited longer for a diagnosis than white patients. The exception was lung cancer, where the median wait time was 103 days for black patients, 115 days for Asian patients, and 129 days for white patients. The Guardian also discovered the median myeloma diagnosis wait time for black people was 37% longer than for white people. Dr. Sophie Castell, the chief executive of Myeloma UK, said myeloma patients in general and black patients in particular experience some of the longest waits for a diagnosis in the country. She added, the disparity will probably worsen as a result of the pandemic. She said, the longer it takes to be diagnosed, the more likely patients are to suffer avoidable yet irreversible lifelong complications like broken bones and spines. She added, this is absolutely unacceptable. Everyone deserves the same opportunity to get a timely diagnosis and live well for as long as possible. With breast cancer, the difference in diagnosis wait times becomes even larger among the patients waiting the longest. Overall, the median wait time was 13 days for white patients, 13 days for Asian patients, and 14 days for black patients. The gap between black and white patients grows alarmingly among the 10% of patients waiting the longest. The median for white patients waiting longest is 41 days. For Asian patients, it is 56 days, and for black patients, it is 73 days. It means black patients waiting the longest for a breast cancer diagnosis wait an entire month longer than white women who are also forced to wait. Delith Morgan, the chief executive of Breast Cancer Now, said black women were more likely to be diagnosed with more advanced breast cancer, for which survival outcomes are poorer. She said, it's deeply concerning that this data suggests black and Asian women may also be waiting longer than white women to receive a diagnosis of breast cancer after presenting with symptoms, and we urgently need to understand why this is the case. The revelations follow a series of stories by The Guardian exposing major health disparities in England and the United Kingdom. Michelle Mitchell said that more needs to be done now to understand and tackle drivers of inequality. She said, for this to happen, our next Prime Minister needs to make cancer a priority. Crucially, they must take targeted action to address inequalities and ensure an important timely diagnosis for everyone.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us listen to an interesting remark from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, concerning the limits of exaltation. Do not ever celebrate any occasion with excessive happiness, which makes you forget halal and haram. That is the permissible and the prohibited.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, calling for good and forbidding evil in the family's environment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of calling for good and forbidding evil in the environment of the family, in the Islamic lifestyle. Obviously, when we talk about the calling for good and forbidding evil, we must know that where can we apply all these things and where we can perform this action. And it starts from the family. Why? Because the family is the smallest social gathering that we have, which starts from the husband and wife. It starts from the parents and the children. And this small gathering, which is a social gathering, we need to start from there and performing this command, which has been made by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that we must call people towards the good and forbid evil. Therefore, when we talk about the family environment, it is necessary that first of all, we make our family members aware of what is good and what is bad, so that when we want our family to reach to perfection, we want to get the perfection, and through this material life, we want to reach to the spiritual levels of the perfection, it is necessary that those who are close to us, those who are living next to us, those who we socialize, we live with them 24 hours, who are next to us, we make this environment peaceful. We make this environment Islamic. We must have an Islamic lifestyle in our home, in our house. And it can be started when we start making aware our family members, when we perform the call for good and forbidding evil in our family. And therefore, we can have this peaceful life if we are performing in our family environment. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of calling for good and forbidding evil in the family environment. We said that it is necessary that a person starts with his family. He starts with his house. He makes his house a spiritual place where he can get to perfection. But on the other hand, when we talk about calling for good, the first step is to make people aware, to make our family members aware of what are the goods and what are evil. But on the other hand, we cannot say our family members every time to perform good. Why? Because unless we have not seen a munkar or evil from them, we cannot stop them. Yes, we make aware them, we give the awareness, we make them to have the knowledge of what is good and what is bad. But on the other hand, then a person in my family has not committed any kind of evil, or if he has not left any kind of goodness, I cannot give him a caution, or I cannot tell him how to perform it. So basically, if the family members when we talk about the Amar bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, it means that to do not just say people not to do this, not to do this. This does not mean that you're performing the Nahi anil Munkar. It means that when a person performs anything which is evil, you must stop them. You must tell them that this is an evil. And you give them some initial knowledge about all those things so that they can prevent themselves from performing such things. Therefore, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran that, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا قُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا those who believed, save yourself and your family members from the hellfire. وَقُودُهَا النَّاسُ وَالْحِجَارَةُ And you must save them. Why? Because the hellfire is the mankind and the stones. Therefore, we must have an environment in our family which takes us towards the perfection, where we are not performing evil and we are performing the goodness, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
These days, computer technology is impacting every aspect of our life, providing a greater ability to place things, events, and people within context. An Iraqi museum has started using the technology and virtual reality headsets to make exhibits interactive and to bring scenes back to life. Visitors can explore heritage sites destroyed by terrorist groups. Now using thousands of photographs, a group of local engineers have given a virtual rebirth to five historic sites in Mosul and the broad Nineveh province. That includes a mosque and its leaning minaret. But this museum brings sites back to life for the people who live in Mosul. Although large parts of the old city remain oceans of debris, authorities are trying to restore historic sites, mosques and churches in Mosul. A private museum along the Tigris River, which opened in mid-June, saw more than 4,000 visitors in its first month. The floating cinema of unknown waters is back in the Italian city of Venice, and spectators are getting buoyant to reach the annual Open Sea Film Festival. On board rowing boats, motorboats, gondolas and whatever capable of floating, spectators sail to the shallows behind the Giudecca Island for this one-of-a-kind cinematic experience. The audience can watch the program from their own boat or a barge with chairs for those without floating transportation. The event consists of a series of screenings, performances and presentations on a floating platform and is held for 12 nights in the Venetian Lagoon.
A new bird species has been discovered on the southernmost islands of the Americas. Biologists are baffled.
Discovering new bird species is very, very difficult and rare because the world has been more focused on observing birds. Therefore, this means the discovery site is unique in the sub-Antarctic zone, on which Chile has important sovereignty. This raises the importance of caring for the environment and unique ecosystems, as these sites will allow us to carry out research on climate change, new species and behaviors.
The tiny bird weighs only 16 grams and has a large beak with black and yellow streaks along its body. Researchers say the animal is a subcategory of a species typically found in the Patagonia forest and inhabits tree trunks. But the newly discovered cousin has surprised scientists as it learned to burrow and live in a harsh tundra climate with bitter temperatures. The Diego Ramirez archipelago where the bird was found is an isolated bit of land. It also lacks mammalian predators and woody plants. Biologists and researchers from Chilean universities and various academic centers studied the birds for 6 years before announcing the new species. The The next moonshot is finally getting closer. NASA says it's ready to test its next-generation rocket ship on an epic launch set for August 29th as part of its mission to send people to the moon.
This new deep space exploration system is going to take us back to the moon and to new science discoveries that we can't even imagine yet. NASA is about to make history with this first flight of the Artemis program.
The mega rocket combines the Space Launch System, or SLS, and the Orion crew capsule it will carry to space. The rocket is due to blast off for a test drive from the U.S. base Kennedy Space Center, sending an empty crew capsule around the moon and back to the Earth. The Artemis 1 test flight is planned to take 6 weeks. It's meant to rigorously stress the systems to determine whether the vehicle is ready to safely carry astronauts. The program aims to establish a long-term lunar colony as a stepping stone to the even more ambitious future voyages that will send people to Mars. The SLS represents the biggest new vertical launch system NASA has built since those flown in the 1960s and 70s. In this story, we tell you about what could be the bright side of climate change, and that's the discovery of dinosaur tracks dating back to 113 million years ago. The tracks were found in the U.S. state of Texas, where drought has dried up parts of Paluxy River. Experts say the tracks belong to a two-legged dinosaur with small arms and weighing 7 tons. They say dinosaurs made the prints as they roamed muddy areas over 100 million years ago. The prints were then covered over with sediment due to a flood. And after that, they turned into limestone, protecting the prints. The experts say the tracks have not been seen either before or in decades. Age does not matter, it's the heart that counts. A Guatemalan female footballer has proved that there is no point one should worry about the age. 57-year-old Alma Salazar has a passion for soccer and takes care of her team's goalpost. Known as Flying Granny, she launches herself and deflects a ball that's looking for the nets. The passion for the sport was born when she was 19 years old. She started training with a men's team where she often found a place as a goalkeeper. Since then, Alma has played for several professional and amateur football clubs. In her room that overlooks a local stadium, Alma keeps trophies she has won on a table, most of them as the least defeated goalkeeper. Locals praise her as an unbeatable goalkeeper.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The evolution of robots has been one of the fascinations of recent technological developments. And now the most cutting-edge achievements in that department were presented to the public during a conference in Beijing. The 4-day annual World Robot Conference was held both offline and online. It featured 3 major events, including forum, expo, and competition. On display were more than 500 sets of robots from 130 companies from China and abroad. The conference gave an idea of how the future of humanity will be impacted by the automations. It shows how they can contribute to different sectors, from the restaurant industry and medicine to elderly care, agriculture, and manufacturing. an inflatable building that explores how people would potentially live on Mars has been unveiled in the British city of Bristol. It's a two-story structure with an area of 570 square feet powered by solar panels. It's designed to cope with temperatures as low as minus 63 degrees Celsius. Although the Martian house will be displayed above ground, its lower level will be fully buried to maximize protection against the harsh environment on Mars. Inside, the top floor features a hydroponic living room filled with decorative plants that feed into a circular wastewater system. A team of experts helped develop the design, taking into consideration the complexity of transporting materials to the Red Planet and what is already there.
So in the gold inflatable structure which you see above you, that's the main living space of the Martian house. It's gold to reflect dangerous solar rays and cosmic radiation, and it's inflatable because it would be filled with a special concrete made of the dust and water that you find on Mars, again to protect you from those dangerous solar and cosmic rays.
The Martian house was envisioned by local artists 7 years ago. The artists also brought together space scientists, architects, engineers, designers, and even school children. The space age dwelling explores what a house on Mars could be like and is meant to for research and experiments about the future. The major objective of the project, however, is to provoke questions about living more sustainably with the resources at hand here on Earth. Japanese plastic food artisans are showcasing their mouth-watering artificial creations at an exhibition in Japan's capital city, Tokyo. From the Leaning Tower of Pizza to fish slicing and cooking, or even the quirky stacked pancakes, you can find almost everything at the exhibit. Other sculptures, including a deep-fried shrimp with four breaded legs scaling a mountain of shredded cabbage like a tiger. Another creation on display is a Tetris game made of chicken. Plastic food artists get really excited for the exhibition each year as they are given a chance to practice their own spin on creativity, bringing food to life with curious characters.
So normally we have to follow orders from clients. We take their views on board when we're making items. Normally that's our work. But for the competition, you can use your imagination. How it finally ends up is totally up to you. I like that aspect of it.
There are some 60 sculptors on display. Some are silly, but others highlight the artist's skills. The models were made with the same careful detail as the rock-solid noodle soups and crispy-looking plastic snacks on display outside Japanese restaurants. There is a lucrative business for them in Japan.
Deforest management plays a key role in mitigating climate change. Like many world countries, China has accelerated environmental and social structural changes in urban spaces to deal with this pertinent issue. The Donggu Forest Park is one such project that has provided city dwellers enough space to breathe. It comes into being from what local people usually called rotten woods. The park on the northern bank of the Xialinge River covers an area of nearly 120 hectares. Nobody would come there before, as the place was full of flies and mosquitoes. But now, with the environment improved and water cleaned in the river, the place has turned into a wonderland, attracting locals and even foreign tourists.
Now the sky is blue, the water clean and the air fresh, with green greeting you wherever you go. The elderly play Tai Chi or do bodybuilding exercises here. Young people play football, basketball and table tennis.
Over the past 20 years, a large number of cities in China have undergone a brief but rapid urban expansion. Most of these cities are now facing social problems such as an aging population and a high prevalence of chronic diseases. The comprehensive environmental improvement program in the area was initiated in 2014 in order to create space for those who want to take a break from their everyday works.
Whilst not being as painful as a broken limb, animals like humans suffer from chronic and acute pain from gum infections, broken teeth, and bacterial spread through the circulation. A 16-year-old elephant in Pakistan is one such case. Madhubala, suffering for years from a dental infection caused by a broken tusk, has finally got relief thanks to vets, dentists. Named after a legendary Indian actress, Madhubala's eyes were taped shut, her legs tied to support her during sedation and subsequent treatment at a Karachi zoo. The vets had to use drills and other heavy surgical tools to extract the infected tusk. She is one of four African elephants being treated in Karachi by an eight-member team from Global Animal Welfare Group, Four Paws. A Pakistani court last year asked Four Paws to assess the health of the animals after local animal rights activists raised concerns about their well-being.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The world's biggest greenhouse gas emitters are increasingly being targeted by litigation challenging their inaction on the climate emergency and attempts to spread misinformation. We have prepared for you an article written by Isabella Kaminsky. The piece is titled US Fossil Fuel Firm Sues Insurer for Refusing to Cover Climate Lawsuit. A fossil fuel firm is suing its insurer for refusing to cover a climate lawsuit in a case that could affect the wider industry's ability to defend itself from litigation. Aloha Petroleum, a subsidiary of the US-based Sunoco, filed a claim against AIG's National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania recently, arguing it had failed to protect Aloha from the mounting costs of defending climate-related claims by local governments in Hawaii. According to documents filed in the latest lawsuit, Aloha Petroleum has already incurred more than $880,000 in defense costs and expects these to grow significantly as litigation progresses. Its insurance company will not pay out. The lawsuit follows another filed by the insurance company Everest in June, which is asking Massachusetts Superior Court to make a similar decision about whether coverage can be denied to Gulf Oil. These are some of the first disputes over insurance coverage for climate crisis litigation to be heard in the courts of law. Both insurance companies say climate litigation is covered by exclusions for pollution in their clients' general liability policies. If they succeed, the fossil fuel firms could be on the hook for millions of dollars in legal fees, in addition to any future damages awarded by courts of law. The only previous decision on this subject was in 2012, when the Virginia Supreme Court ruled that Steadfast Insurance Company had no duty to cover the energy firm AES Corporation in a climate lawsuit brought by the Native American village of Kivalina. The Kivalina lawsuit was unsuccessful, but in the U.S., that usually still leaves defendants liable for their legal costs. Russell Butland, a senior associate at law firm Allen & Overy, who advises companies on commercial disputes, said the extent to which the latest lawsuits set a precedent for future claims would depend on the specific wording of insurance policies and the relevant laws in particular places. He said, however, exclusions for pollution risks are a common feature of all types of insurance, and therefore the outcome will be of real interest to all companies and all individual directors seeking to manage their risk for similar litigation. The world's biggest greenhouse gas emitters are increasingly being targeted by litigation challenging their inaction under climate emergency and their attempts to spread misinformation. The lawsuits underlying Aloha Petroleum's claim were brought by local governments in Hawaii against companies including Sunoco, ExxonMobil, and Shell. Honolulu's case alleges the big oil firms engaged in a coordinated multi-front effort to deny the threat posed by global heating, to discredit the science of the climate crisis, and to deceive the public about the reality and consequences of the impacts of their fossil fuel pollution. It was also one of the swathes of lawsuits given the go-ahead to be heard in a state court this year. The latest such ruling was made recently in Delaware. Jason Reeves, a partner in the London office of the law firm Zelle, said this was important because plaintiffs were more likely to succeed on their claims than in federal courts of law and to obtain hefty judgments. Even if judgments were years away, the cost of defending the case could be high. Jason Reeves added, you will see a continued escalation of parallel climate litigation cases between policyholders and their insurers, as policyholders present claims in relation to defending these lawsuits. It is not only a risk for the fossil fuel industry. Mary Sweeters, a senior strategist for the Insurer Our Future campaign, said insurers underwriting the polluters that were subject to climate litigation may face significant losses.